The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 299 for Wednesday, the 23rd of November, 2011. My name is Jim Race. I am here in California with far off in Wales, over there in the Europe, as also known as the UK, Martin Darlington. Good evening to you, Martin.
It is evening. It's lovely. It's lovely. And I'd just like to add my...
You know, I had a feeling that was coming. That sounded like a Guinness.
It was indeed, yes. I haven't done a call with Jim and Guinness for a long time.
Well,
in fact, what have I done more recently, a Guinness or a Jim? I think a Jim.
Doubtful. It's been a while since we've actually been, at least during periods where we both can enjoy a refreshing beverage. So this will, once again, be a refreshing beverage sort of show. And that was me enjoying some of that. A bit of stuff going on, interviews we do have for this show. Jules managed to get what he is telling me, and I'm sure it is, a very kick-ass interview with Dr. Martin Raines, who many of you will know, the official MotoGP statistician. He's going to be presenting that to us at some point in the show. We'll have to figure out where we put it. Might just leave it up to our brilliant producer, Jules Cisek. And then you're still trying to track down James Whiteman. Boy, the weather and everything's been conspiring. I know Motorcycle Live is going on right now, Martin, and that's a big deal over there. It's a bigger deal.
I mean, it's the NEC bike show. It's the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham. It's the biggest bike show in the UK. And Jim is hosting there, or James rather, is hosting there right through till Monday. They've extended it to. And apparently crowds are really, really healthy this year, which is a good sign. So we're hoping to put a flight for him to come and see me either later next week or the week after. But obviously now my base is running 7 days a week. It has to be on one of my days off so I can be sure to be there.
Sure, but my understanding is you're going to have a little bit of, in not too long now, a little bit of, more of a breather, being not the only pilot on the flight line, and might be able to join us a fair bit more often, maybe?
Yeah, no, absolutely. At the moment, I don't get any standby days because our shifts work 5-on-2-off, 5-on-2-off, 5-on-5-off, with two pilots, which we'll have from the 1st of January, which is a great relief. Obviously, that's too many days for it, both of us to work. So we get standby days where we can be sent elsewhere to work, but often they end up being days off that you don't know are going to be a day off until it's finished and you haven't been called. But it does mean it gives me the leeway of doing calls early in the morning, whereas on winter hours, I'm leaving home at 6:30 so to get to work on time. So to do a call before that would be crazy.
Yeah, and people have no idea because, you know, you and Jules have done a lot of calls with you very, very early in the morning. And frankly, it's a stalwart effort for you to even try and do that. But I think the funniest part, and perhaps we should extract some of these sometimes, is the little chats that we have beforehand when you're still trying to wake up.
Yeah, no, I don't think that'd be very fair to do that, but probably very entertaining, though. So, yeah, do it.
Yeah, just a little, under the weather is not the term. It's just a wee bit tired. Especially when I crack a beer in your ear and it's, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning for you. And you're like, oh God, that kind of sounds good right now.
And you can just hear the clink of the teaspoon in my coffee cup.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very faint because you're trying not to make too much noise.
Yeah. Just quickly on Martin Raines. If anybody, particularly in the off season, is feeling a withdrawal symptoms of bike trivia, you can find him on Twitter. He's at MotoGP Mart, MART, all one word, and he does this thing where about once a week he'll send out a little quiz question, and some of them are absolutely, even with Google, it's really difficult sometimes to track down the answer in it, but it's great fun, and he is the font of all motorcycle racing knowledge.
Literally. He wrote the book. You wrote the book, so.
Yeah. Him and Julian Ryder write the annual at the end of the year.
Yep.
It's quite good. Now, you have some errata to clear up, I believe.
We do, because, as usual, I think Jules, or at least me, or somebody screwed up in the last episode. We were talking about WCM. We made an error, as we well do, especially when we're talking off the cuff from memory. But I mean, assuming either Jules figured this out or a fan wrote in, I'm not sure which. But the ban that happened in this is the fix, if you will. The ban that happened in 2003 with the R1 base motor, that was when it actually happened. 2005, the Blada WCM team raced the full season. They were on the entry list for 2006, but never showed up. So we wanted to clear that up. It's still a very interesting and, frankly, timely story, Martin, considering that we're moving into the world of CRT shortly. In fact, it went on today. We had some testing going on. Colin Edwards got back out. We'll chat about that later. The more things change, the more they stay the same, or is it the other way around? The more things stay the same? I don't know.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. Interesting to see. You had a mention that I thought, speaking of timely, because I read another bit from our friend Bernie Ecclestone today on a certain race facility or not in the great state of Texas here in the United States. Fill me in on that, Martin.
Well, it would appear that there's been some kind of financial hiccup. Basically, Bernie Ecclestone, the poison dwarf who runs Formula One and used to run MotoGP, thank goodness he doesn't now, has no loyalty to anything but his bank account, and doesn't really care so long as the punters come in, which does make him fan-friendly, it must be said. They were meant to be going to Austin, Texas. There was meant to be a MotoGP on the back of that at this new circuit. And it would appear that the public funds that had been promised by, I presume, the state of Texas, or maybe it's the city of Austin.
The state of Texas, correct.
Aren't actually there.
Yeah,
or yet.
It's a bit of political swinging back and forth, but the gist of it is that the contract shifted from the original people that were going to run it, which is Full Throttle, to tried to get shifted to the circuit management. Now, I saw something that was interesting yesterday. I'll bring this up because I saw this through a source very unlikely to see something like that. But I happened to be on LinkedIn the other day, and Chuck Axelin, who used to basically run the Roberts team when they were running with the KR3 and all that stuff, and well into the end of where both of the Roberts brothers were running until that team folded, is listed as the racing director for Circuit of the Americas. And I saw that on LinkedIn. That was his title. And completely sideways way to find out something like that, but I thought that was interesting. Anyway, the bottom line is that, yes, the state of Texas had promised to prepay this $25 million sanctioning fee, which is fine, and I think that's something that Bernie should get for a new race, but personally. Then they changed their minds, and those funds weren't available, and then the contracts fell apart trying to be moved around. The bottom line is, at least right now, as of this date, it kind of looks like that race isn't going to happen. And we may have more info on that for episode number 300, which should be up in a week or two, or probably a couple of weeks. We're going to make sure that we've got a real cracker for you guys on that one. But in the meantime, there's something going on in Wales that you were mentioning.
I mean, it was on BBC Wales, so it's on the BBC News generally do report facts. So it is a fact that there are a group of rich people who are proposing to build a £200 million race circuit facility in South Wales near Ebervale, providing a, their words, superb motor racing facility and work for what is a depressed area. So the fact is someone said they intend to do it. That's a long way from it being done. But please, if they're going to, and anyone from that group is listening, don't get Tilke to do it. Don't get Herman Tilke. I'll do it. Get Jack Nicklaus to do it. He'd probably do a better job. I know there have been some... I mean, Aragon is a fantastic circuit, and Tilke was involved with that, but I don't want another cookie-cutter bloody circuit.
That being said, Martin, if you looked at the... I think the design for the Austin circuit was brilliant.
This is the interesting thing, because South Wales and Eber Vale, it's not the valleys when they talk about the valleys of Wales. That's further west in the Swansea area, but... It is, there are valleys there. I mean, it is, I suppose, the start of those same valleys. It's very, very hilly, which could make for some interesting, and we've spoken about this before, there are good tracks that are flat, but generally the best tracks, the Bernos, I've just gone blank now, Aragon. What was the South African one which World Superbikes were going to? Kyalami.
Kyalami.
Absolutely fantastic circuits. Well, if they have these elevation changes, it just makes it more dramatic. Portimao.
Sure. Absolutely.
So it could be interesting.
Yeah, he's done some. And I would bet Martin, especially probably after Shanghai, which was another one of his creations, that got roundly panned, that maybe he's taking some of this to heart and, you know, trying to push these circuit developers to make sure that they have something that is better to work with from a long-term standpoint and visually appealing. But, you know, part of the thing about a flat circuit is that from a television perspective, it's much easier to cover. Who knows? But that'd be nice.
As we said after I went to Valencia, and 80% of the fans can see 80% of the circuit, and that's great. I'd rather see the 20% of the circuit I could at Catalunya, because the racing's much more interesting, you know.
Sure. No, absolutely.
I'm not a fan of Valencia. I know the last corner's interesting and all that, but...
If it is built
and it's got good, very good transport links to that bit of South Wales, because it's South East Wales, it's right next to the M4. It's just up from the M4 motorway.
I have to say something. I think I'm a little bit prejudiced against Valencia simply because it's been the last circuit on the MotoGP series for quite some time. And it's so often that we go there with not much to decide. But that has changed a little bit in the last couple of years. But I have to point out that I love watching the World Superbike Series race there. So there shouldn't be that much reason why I am not enamored with it for a MotoGP series. I don't know.
Well, this year in particular, because we were hoping with a couple of rounds to go, that the 125 and the Moto2 championships were going to go right down to the wire with a couple of points between them. And unfortunately, Nico Troll got his mojo back, and Zarco still couldn't find his.
Right.
That's not fair, actually. He had a fantastic season, but he just couldn't quite close the gap. And the great shame of Marquez's injury,
sure.
Injuries, were, you know, was the fact that I mean, as someone said, Bradle crashed and walked back to the pits and was made world champion before the race had finished, you know. In fact, he was made world champion, sorry, during qualifying, wasn't he? He was officially world champion. So, yeah, it was a shame, but very deserving anyway.
Yeah.
And just a quick one, on the 300th episode...
You're talking about the calendar contest coming up.
Well, we have got that, indeed.
Yeah. Let me preface this, and I'll sneak past if you were going to say something else, but... And I think this would be the perfect time right after we remind you guys out there in Motopod land of this. We're going to go ahead after what I'm about to say and run the Martin Raines interview. Why is that important? Well, A, it's going to kick ass because Jules is great at that sort of thing. And Martin Raines is fascinating. And it's a good long interview that should give you lots of insight. Secondarily, and apparently he's a fan, Martin, of the show, which I think is very cool. Secondarily, though, we do have this calendar contest for the Moto Matters calendars, which are very popular every year, and with the shooting of Scott Jones. Maybe others. I don't know if there's others participating, but certainly Scott's work is brilliant. Because of this, we're going to have the calendar contest. You guys need to listen very carefully to the Martin Raines interview coming up. We're going to ask a question, and then we're going to pick five right answers out of random some sort of thing during the next episode, episode 300. So you guys will need to listen to the interview. The question will come up. You guys need to send in your answers. You'll get a 2011 Moto Matters calendar, courtesy of Moto Matters.
It's not
Moto
2012 calendar.
2012, did I? Yeah, boy, you know, we're not so good on the dates right now, are we?
I was going to say, 2011, you can get those really cheap anyway.
2012, thank you, once again. We're not restarting the show for that. And what do you do to secure one of those? Well, you will send your answer to 300, the number 300300 at motopodcast.com with your answer. It's not a question of how fast you get it in. It's a question of if you get it in before we do episode 300, which, as I mentioned before, will be in a couple of weeks, something like that. So this is the kind of year where we sort of slack. It's the winter season, but we'll try and keep you updated. In fact, we've got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. Just a reminder there, we're going to run the interview now with Martin Raines and Jules Cisek. Send in your answers to 300 at motopodcast.com, and we will announce the winners in the next show. So, Martin, let's listen in virtually to the interview with Jules and the other Martin, and then we'll come back.
Hello, this is Jules Cisek. I have on the phone with me Dr. Martin Raines, who is the official MotoGP statistician. He's over in the UK. How are you, Martin?
I'm fine, thank you. It's good to be with you, Jules.
Very nice to have you on the show. I mean, we've actually been trying to schedule this for a long time. We were hoping to meet in person at one of the rounds this year, but we missed each other. So so we'll decide just to do this over the phone. And it's a little different because, like you said, you're used to talking to people and seeing them, and there's a lot of gesturing involved when you talk about motorcycles, you know?
It certainly is, because we're passionate about it. I think the passion comes across when we're face-to-face. This is the first time I've done it over the phone, but I'm sure we can get along all right.
Yep. So you're obviously a big fan of motorcycle racing. Have you done any racing yourself in the past?
A long time ago. I thought I was racing, but I didn't actually very often race up front. But yes, I suppose it's now 35 years ago when I raced. I raced in a sort of production 250cc Suzuki back in the day. At the club races in England, probably the most famous one where I raced was Aintree, where they have the famous horse race. And for the British listeners, they'll know that. And there's also a racing track that they held the Formula One car race in the 50s there. So it was quite nice.
Wow.
Yeah, nice experience. Yeah.
So what level was this? Like a club racing level?
Yes, it was just club racing. Very basic, very low level indeed. Yes.
Very cool.
Yeah.
But you stayed a fan, obviously, of the sport. And how did you get into the role of this MotoGP statistician, the official guy?
All right. Well, I sort of followed the sport and did a lot of things like race and marshal and so on at the low level. But I was always passionate about Grand Prix racing. And, of course, you scored to the one race a year we had in this country, which was the TT originally and Silverstone. I first went to the TT, I think, back in about 1974. And then it went to Silverstone in 77. So I was always a fan. And that was sort of the day of the cup final, almost the equivalent of. That was a big day of the year to go to the Grand Prix. And then started wanting to create a database just to learn, really, how to use a database. And thought, well, using the Grand Prix results as a basis for something interesting to do. And once I created the database with lots of results in, there was some interesting information that I could query out of that, but nobody else was using. And this was sort of round about 1994, 95 time. And people didn't know how many podiums people had had, how many starts, how many pole positions, that sort of data just wasn't freely available. So that's how I started out. And fortunately, very, very fortunately, and I thank this person every day and every time I go to the Grand Prix, I got in contact with Dennis Noyes,
who
is, I know, is a friend of your podcast, and he was working for Dorna in those days, and he sort of took my numbers and wrote very good stories around it to distribute to the TV, the teams, and so on. And it grew from there.
Excellent, excellent. And the stats that are on MotoGP.com, are they coming from that same database?
No, okay. they are the MotoGP, the Dorna database. I have my own database that I'm trying to persuade Dorna that they need the information I've got in my database in theirs.
Yeah.
I did do some work with them to get the database to the stage that it's at, but that was back in 2000.
Gotcha.
Since 2000, the database has just added the new results on and not really developed in terms of the historical results. So I have my own standalone database that is just used by myself on my own computer. As I said, originally I did it with Dennis for till about 1999, and then when Dennis left Dorna, from then onwards I took over this role of official GP statistician, producing the statistics for each race.
And you're also involved with the books, right?
I have some involvement. I've worked on several books in terms of just providing results and so on. But the main one I've done, well, I've done two. I've done one with Dennis, which was the 50 year of Grand Prix racing. And then more recently, the 60 year that I did with Julian Ryder.
So
that was the official 60 year history of Grand Prix racing that was done in conjunction with Dorna and the FIM as the official sort of record of 60 years of Grand Prix racing.
Right, right. Can I ask you, by the way, what software do you use?
I just use Microsoft Access for the database.
Oh, my God. No. Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. It's very straightforward. I'm not a computing man, and it works tremendous. Like the database is quite straightforward. It's just of results, really. And I've got something like 80,000 lines of results in there. And then it's very easy to create new queries, so it's very good for this purpose.
I had a friend of mine who's a big fan of yours, and he's also a technologist, and he was expecting you had some kind of crazy expert system.
No, not at all. No. I hope to think that a bit of the expertise is in my head. Because the most difficult thing to do is to think up of what to ask the database, really.
No, actually, I was just going to say that some of the stats that you've published, like on Wednesdays, some of them seem very intuitive. Where there's no way that you could get that kind of data from the computer. You have to know where to start the query.
Absolutely, and that's where I take the time. And I suppose that helps because I've been around watching Grand Prix racing for 40 years, that when something happens, I think, well, has this happened before, or how long is it since this has happened before? So that's where the thought process comes in. All the database does is supply the answers to the questions, but the difficult bit is thinking of the questions, as it were.
Got it. Right. So, and you actually have a consulting company that's your full time job. Like
my full time job, yes, is I'm an engineer. And I have a partnership in an engineering consultancy company, and that is focuses on engineering quality and reliability. So that's my day job. This providing statistics is just a passion and a part-time thing done at weekends and times when I can get to do it.
Got it. And then it's basically like a but you like crunching numbers, it sounds like.
I do, yes. I'm a numbers man. I'm not a wordsmith I don't find writing easy. I don't claim to be a journalist in any way, shape or form. What I provide are facts for other people to write stories around. So the facts that I provide go out to the TV commentators and they can use it. But then it's picked up very often by websites, by magazines and so on. And they fill out they play it out to make a story around the facts that sort of are produced. So I don't claim to be a journalist in any way.
Yeah, but you definitely provide some excellent data for us.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk about this season that we had. And, you know, obviously marked with some tragedy. But also the final season of the 800s, you know, Honda finally got their championship. In the beginning of the 800 era, everybody was kind of worried that the series was designed for for Honda, by Honda, you know, and that didn't turn out to be the case. You know, did you find any interesting trends along the way during the 800 era?
I think the most interesting trend really was that the person who won the first championship and the last one was Casey Stoner. And I think maybe that if Honda had signed Casey Stoner in 2007, the records of that era would be considerably different.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot talked about the change from 1,000cc to 800cc, and that the 800cc era was perhaps a little disappointing. I don't really agree with that. Certainly some people suggest that. I'm not so sure whether it was going to 800cc's from 1,000 or the other changes that were made. I'm not convinced that going back to 1,000cc's will make a massive change from what we've seen over the last couple of years.
Right, because of the electronics, the kind of riding style, you have to have much more precision, less loose.
Yeah, I'm not so sure whether with the way that the electronics have developed, and the big limitation for the 1,000 will be the same as it is for the 800cc, is the fuel.
Oh yeah, of course.
And every time you spin the wheel, you're using fuel that's not taking you forward, so you're wasting energy. So there will still be this drive to make sure by the electronics that you're not spinning up like we saw in the 990 era, where there wasn't the same limitation on fuel. So I think the electronics have developed, and I'm convinced, and I was before the rule was brought in, and I'm still convinced that going to a single tyre or a single tyre supplier with standard tyres had a bigger effect than going from 1,000cc to 800cc.
I think a lot of people would agree. A lot of people would agree.
Because by the very nature, those tyres are developed for the guys who are winning the races, and if, for instance, there could have been some flexibility, and even if it was Bridgestone doing it, if this year they could have developed special tyres for Tony Elias, for instance,
mm-hmm.
he would have been closer to the front, or if they could have provided special tyres for the Ducati. I'm not saying the Ducati would have been winning races, but I'm sure with different tyres specially designed for it, they could have been closer to the front, and therefore the racing would have been better. So I know why the single tyre rule was brought in, and that was economics. However, I do believe that it's had a detrimental effect on the racing.
I have to agree. And you know, the other thing is, been brought up is the corner speed of the 800s, because you have to keep a higher corner speed. There seems to be more, I don't know. We've always had, you know, high sides and those kinds of accidents, but there's during this era, it seemed like if you were either on rails or you were in trouble.
I think that again is a function of the tire, and that the tire seems to grip and grip and grip, and then all of a sudden let go. It would seem to me much more sensible, and Bridgestone can do this now because they're not in a competitive situation, to make a tyre that maybe didn't have the same ultimate grip as the tyres do now, but give some warning of when it's going to lose adhesion. And it does seem, like you said, there's been perhaps a lot of eyesides, a lot of accidents, because when it lets go now, the corner speed is so high and the angle of lean is such that there's no way that the riders are going to get back from the massive angle of lean that is being achieved by the tyres. So I'm not sure whether we've got the advantages of going to a single tyre, but we've perhaps got the disadvantages that have accrued from that.
I think
in the past, when we had the different tyres, like the Michelin and Bridgestone competition, one of the tyres would be better in the early part of the race or some type of corners, and the other tyre will be better at the other part of the race, so it led to more passing.
Yes, and the bikes were set up for those specific tires too.
Absolutely, and the riders could take advantages of those tires. So it meant that maybe one was better under braking, so they could make passes, but one would be better at the exit of the corner. So the next person is getting advantage at a different part. So I think because everybody is on a very uniform motorcycle, it makes it difficult for the passes to be made.
And yet, there's if you look at the Moto2 class, which is about, you know, the same bike, same tires, pretty much.
I think that's totally different. Personally, I think that the level I think there are so many people who can ride the Moto2 bikes at a level, and they're going so much slower. In effect, the tyres are probably not as ultimately as great around the angles of lean. The electronics development is nowhere near as high. And no. that allows the passing. I think the problem is with the high electronics and the tyres in the 800cc class, it allows very late braking, so there's not much opportunity to brake under there. Very accurate corner, and there's probably very one fast line around the corner. Where in the Moto2, there's alternative lines, there's underbraking, so there's options for people overtaking. So I'm not saying... single tyre rule is always bad, but I think on the current machines at the very top level, it doesn't add to the spectacle.
Gotcha.
I do understand why the decision was made, because of economics.
Yeah, which, you know, this is debatable also, but...
Totally agree with you. I'm not quite sure who was saving money from that one.
The CRT rules are going to change the game, obviously, for 2012. We don't expect to see them up front yet, but you know, it's pretty obvious that Dorna is interested in making the CRT more of a centerpiece of GP racing in the future. With, you know, with we already have Moto2, we're now going to have Moto3, which sounds fantastic, frankly. And you know, the CRT thing, is it going to become kind of like a Moto One, you think, or is it going to allow actually more variety?
I find it difficult to see how it goes in the future. I do think that something had to be done, because I think we're going down a dead end with the factory domination, and unfortunately we've got to a point now where it's not an ideal point to start from. But we cannot start from anywhere else. And therefore, the CRT idea is maybe not a perfect development. But when everybody who I've discussed it with say, well, it's not great, well, yes, what's the alternative? And I'm not so sure what alternatives there are to it. So I'm quite excited by it. I think next year there'll be the 12 factory and satellite bikes out front, and I do think there'll be a gap. There'll be two racing one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a few reasons. One, the bikes will take a time to develop, but the riders that are looking towards going into CRT in this first year, I think due to it being unknown, are probably not the best of the next batch of riders to come along. So I think there could be two racing one, but I'm hoping by the end of the season that perhaps the best of the CRT bikes are getting close to the floor of the satellite bikes. However, there are only 12 factory and satellite bikes, so even that, you know, maybe there are one or two that have been slower of the bikes. For instance, unfortunately, we mentioned Tony Elliott from last year. They've been culled. And therefore, those 12 people now who are on factory or satellite bikes are, yeah, arguably the 12 best riders in the world. So it's going to be very, very difficult to get with those guys. But I cannot see an alternative to it. I think Dorna needed to take back control of the rules. I think they've gone down a blind alley by trying to make it elitist and factory only. I think by the writing was on the wall some years ago when they got wouldn't allow Peter Clifford with his team to race.
Oh yeah, we just talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
If he was allowed to do that, there would have been a few teams, maybe the Roberts team and Peter Clifford team and so on, already ready made to continue with the CRT, and that could have filled the grid as a factory in a more natural progression. As the factory teams had gone down, they would have been there to take over.
Right.
But if this CRT hadn't been introduced, we could have ended up with a grid of 12 riders next year. So thank God for the CRT, I say.
Yeah, very true.
Or Dorna, or whoever it is who came up with these ideas, because it could have been desperate if we didn't have them.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and... So you're a fan of motorcycle racing. Are you also a fan of any particular racers?
I have had my heroes in the past, and you know, from Mike Elwood and Barry Sheen through to Freddie Spencer, and I was a big fan of Loris Caprossi, who is retiring now.
Yeah.
So I am a big fan of the riders. I think everyone who sits on those machines are heroes. And in recent years, I'm very, very impressed with Casey Stoner. I think he is. I'm fortunate enough to be able to get trackside right next up to the barrier, and I think every time he goes out on the track, he gives 100%. And I think as he goes past, I always think, well, I don't think there's anybody in the world or anybody I've ever seen who could ride push the limits of the laws of physics, perhaps like Casey does.
Right. Yeah. No. In fact, there's been a lot of comparisons lately. The last few months made to Freddie Spencer, who you always talk about as well. I think Freddie Spencer was another one of those guys who just pushed way beyond.
Absolutely. He could just get on the machine and almost any machine and go immediately fast. And of all the riders I've seen in the 40 years I've been watching the sport, I would say those two people are the most naturally talented of the ones that I've seen in terms of riding a bike fast.
Right.
I think Casey can ride a bike faster, as fast, if not faster, than anybody I've ever seen. He may not have the racing skills that Valentino Rossi has, because he's more, I think he likes to go out and set his own pace, and that pace is usually fast enough to win the race.
Right.
I don't think he's quite as keen to get involved in close battling as Valentino Rossi has done. But in terms of riding the bike out and out fast, I think Casey Stoner is a very special young man.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Do you think that there's anybody, maybe Casey, in the paddock right now or in the future coming into the sport that will have the potential to pull off a... you know, like a Rossi-like string of championships?
I'm not sure, because I think the level is very, very high now. Like, as much as I've said about Casey Stoner, next year he could end up third or fourth in the championship behind Danny Pedrosa and Orgil Renzo. All those three guys, I don't include Rossi at the moment, because I think the Ducati is so far behind, I do not believe that they can make the leap from where they are now to winning races next year. I'm not saying not win, maybe a wet race or whatever, but I don't think they will make that leap. So I think there are those three riders who are as high a level as almost, you know, we've seen over the last 40 years. I think it's similar to when we had Wayne Rainey, Kevin Swamps and Eddie Lawson. It's back to that. It's three people who are very, very high level. And whichever one managed to have a season without falling off, you know, and have consistency, will win the title. If you look at Danny Pedrosa's results this year when he stayed on the bike, he has given Casey Stoner an hard time.
He's extremely fast.
And on his day, he's every bit as good as Casey Stoner. Olga Renzo's persistence and doggedness and determination is phenomenal. I think he had a fantastic championship year this year. You know, he came second in the championship, tried to defend his championship and did superb. And probably at the end crashed because he was trying so much to defend his championship and was with a shout even up to a few races to go. So I think those three are as talented as... we've seen for some good while. I do believe that in the 990 era and even at the end of the 500cc era where McDoom was dominating, I think there was one dominant rider. And in fact, I just came across an interview done with Wayne Rainey back in 2002. And he actually said in that interview, Valentino Rossi does not have a challenger in this paddock at the moment. He doesn't have a rival.
Right.
The rival is somebody who we don't know about yet.
Exactly, exactly. I remember that. I remember him saying exactly that.
And that was so true, because we're the best one in the world. I think, like, the people he was racing against in those days, the Alex Barros and Seti Gibbonos, were a division below what the ultimate performance Rossi could achieve. And it was only, I think, with the arrival of Danny Pedrosa and Keith Stone and Jorge Lorenzo. But now we've got some people really top level, as good as I said, we've had in terms of a few people together for 20 years.
And the same kind of hunger, and yeah.
The young, they're hungry, they're at the peak of the career altogether. Yeah. They've all started motorcycle racing very young and therefore got vast experience. They know the machines. I think they think about it. They respect each other very good, and I love that. I think they really think about the racing, all three of them. They don't maybe always in interviews come across like that. I'm fortunate enough to see them in more private moments, and I think they're all good thinking guys who are very, very top men, and we should be grateful that we've got those three guys. And they're still quite young and could go on for a few more years. But I don't see anyone dominating. I think that was the question, like someone has in the past, because we've got a couple of people who, if the guy at the top is on 99% of his game rather than 100%, the others will take advantage of it.
Right.
So Casey did win 10 races this year. He may win the championship again next year. I think I cannot see him winning 10 races because I think the others will pressurise him. Because Danny was out for the first few races or early on in the season with his injury, and Jorge missed the last few races. So I think it will be tough to win 10 races in a season again.
Yeah, but
do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I do. I'm just hoping that it's not going to be like at this track, Casey Stoner wins by 10 seconds. At this track, Danny Pedrosa wins by 10 seconds. And at this track, Jorge Lorenzo wins by 10 seconds. So that the championship seems close, but the racing is not, right? Because that's kind of the pattern we've been falling into.
But I don't think that's unusual. I think like we look back at the, maybe sometimes with rose-colored spectacles, if we look back in the battles between Kevin Swanson and Wayne Rainey, they battled early on in the race, but by the end of the race, very often there was, 10 seconds between the two of them. It's not unusual for that to happen. And I think also that is a case when you've got two or three riders who are at very the same level. They sort of break away from the other guys, don't they?
Yeah.
When Rossi was very dominant, he was not of that style of riding. He would make sure he would spend the first half a dozen laps making sure his bike's all right, warm his tyres up. And then he actually enjoyed the cut and thrust of the racing. I think now that because we've got three riders of the same level, but it's that the riders cannot afford to say, well, I'm going to allow five or six laps for my tyres to warm up, because by that time, the other guy's gone.
Fantastic point.
And therefore, I think that's why the races are more spread out. As well as the tyre problem and the electronics, I think the function of having a few riders, three riders who are perhaps spectacularly good, means that they go from right from the green light, because they know if they can get a couple of seconds advantage early on, they can hold on to that.
Right. That's the only way, yeah.
Well, I think you agree, in the past, where Rossi, when he was racing against Seti Givinau and Max Biaggi, he would sort of make a race of it, probably more than he needed to. If you remember the time, I think it was 2003, where halfway through the race in Australia, he was given a 10-second penalty.
Yeah, of course. Classic.
He just disappeared in the distance then.
Yeah.
And I have little doubt that he could have done that on a more regular basis. But that wasn't his way. He enjoyed the cut and thrust of the racing and made it entertaining for all of us.
Yeah. Yep. Which is why he's got so many fans.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And we need him back up front. So let's hope that the Ducati do improve with the new chassis that they're making. And we see him up front with those other guys. It would be much better for all of us, wouldn't it?
It would be, definitely.
And when he wins, he gives me plenty to write about, because he always creates some new statistics.
Right.
I've been fortunate in that the time I've been working on the statistics, there's been a time when we've had Rossi, and he's given me lots to do over the last 10 years.
Well, you know, Casey Stoner, I mean, if he sticks around, he could be knocking on the door on a lot of those records. But I have a feeling that Casey Stoner is not in it to win records or anything like that. He's in it to race. And when he's done having fun with the racing bit, he's just going to go fishing.
I absolutely 100% agree. I think the most important race for Casey Stoner is the next one, and that's the only important one, is that he wants to win the next race, and when he's won that, he moves on to the next one.
Yeah.
I think he will look at this. He is very interested in the history of the sport. He's very passionate about it, and I spoke to him. I happened to get 15 minutes just private chat to him at Valencia, not as a journalist or anything, just talking to him. And he does read the statistics I produce. He's the only rider who's ever said that he reads and likes to find out about the history of the sport and the people who've raced in the past. He's passionate about the sport. I don't think that always comes across in the interviews. But I do agree with you. I don't think he will ever sort of drop down. Once he stops winning, or at some point, maybe in 2 or 3 years' time, when his contract comes to an end, he'll just say, that's it, I've had enough, I'll go fishing. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. You think, by the way, there's any truth to the losing a second lap for having a child?
Well, you know, that may be the race more interesting. It would give the others a better chance.
Yeah.
I think that was a bit worrying for the others, where he said at Valencia, and probably it was mind games, after winning at Valencia, he said that it was the first time he'd taken a risk all season. So maybe he's got a bit more, minus the 1 second for having a child, and we'll see some good racing.
That'd be great, actually.
Yes, it would. Yes. I don't honestly think that the racing will change significantly, though, with the thousands, unfortunately. I think that some people are thinking it's going to go back to the 990 era, and, you know, that's going to change everything.
Well, let's hope the cameras, go and show us some of the CRT racing, because that might be interesting.
Absolutely. At least having more riders on the grid is the first step towards filling some of the gaps that we've had. And certainly as a spectator at the circuit, I think the bikes will get spread out quite quickly. So at least you'll have something to watch rather than seeing the top 17 riders go by, covered by 10 or 15, 20 seconds early in the race, and then nothing at all for a minute and a half. So at least there'll be something there for the spectators. Maybe for the TV, it will not make much difference. As you said, perhaps, hopefully, though, the TV will drop back, the cameras will drop back, and we'll see some battles of the CRT riders.
I mean, I think if Dorna wants to push the whole CRT idea forward, they're going to make sure the directors are pointing to those bikes.
Yes. And, of course, it's really going back to how it used to be. Like, if you look in the 70s, there'd be a couple of MVs on the grid, there'd be a couple of Suzuki factory bikes, there'd be a couple of Yamahas.
And a bunch of privateers, the rest of the grid.
A bunch of privateers on maybe Kawasaki's or Suzuki's, the Suzuki twins in Series Frames, all those guys. But however, in those days, the guy finishing sixth or seventh was very often lapped.
Right.
I'm not quite sure whether we would accept that now with the TV coverage that we've got. If you look in 1974, that very often, I've got the book in front of me here, like at the opening race in France, the guy who finished seventh was lapped. West Germany, the guy who finished eighth was lapped. So, they were spread out in those days. I don't know whether that will be acceptable or not to the viewing public.
Well, we're going to find out not necessarily in Qatar, because Qatar is a strange race. We always talk about that as being kind of like a showcase, and then Jerez is the real deal.
Yeah, and I do think that the rules will develop over time, such that the CRT teams are already talking about control ECU, rev limits, and so on. And I do feel that in due course the distance will close between the two. And then we'll have people on the grid, the teams running the CRT teams, whose business is to go racing.
Exactly.
We depended on the factories, and we should have learned from history. We should always learn from history. And in the past, when times have got tough for the factories in terms of the economics They did it at the end of the 60s. You know, Suzuki dropped out before and so on. There are times where the factories have said, right, that's enough, spend on racing, we'll pull back from the racing. You cannot have a sport that depends on people whose core business is not the racing. At least if they do that, if Yamaha and Honda, unfortunately, maybe in the future, let's hope they don't decide to pull out, we have these teams ready to, at least so we can put a show on, and have some good entertainment. So Grand Prix racing continues, because if we didn't go this way, Grand Prix racing would be under threat.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Fantastic. Okay, Dr. Rains, we have a question for our listeners that you prepared. You want to give it to us now?
Yeah, I'll fire the question. The question is this. Who is the last rider to have scored podium finishes in both the 250cc GP class and 500cc GP class in the same season?
All right.
So it's a rider who's had a top three finish in both 250cc and 500cc in the same season.
The most recent. Excellent. And
so it's the most recent. Yes, it's the most recent person to do that.
And we've got five Moto Matters calendars to give away to the people who get that answer. So send them in.
Yeah.
What was so excellent talking to you.
Can I have a go at answering that to get one of those calendars?
You bet. send your answer in. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope maybe next year we get to meet in person.
That would be absolutely fantastic, and I would like to do one at a race circuit where we've got something, especially once the CRTs have started and we've got some more to talk about on that.
Yeah.
So I don't think any of us know how it's really going to go. Let's keep our fingers crossed that it will be successful.
Yep, I totally agree. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show. Thank you.
Okay, ciao.
Ciao, bye.
All right, many thanks to Dr. Martin Rains. Very cool to get him on the show. Hopefully we'll be having him on again, especially as the season starts to kick in. And thanks, Jules, for doing that. Jules is getting a little bit of a mini vacation this week, although if you think about it, Martin, when you and I do the show, Jules' editing efforts seem to take so much more work.
Yes. And Jules has been carrying the can he's been the anchor man, really, for the last few shows, hasn't he?
Certainly
on the Martin Rains front, I mean that group of Julian Ryder, Toby Moody, Martin Rains, Neil Spaulding, I think we are incredibly lucky to be following bike racing at a time, and then in World Superbikes you got James and Jack. You know, we have some really, really knowledgeable, entertaining commentators who in five or six words can paint a picture.
I noticed you didn't bring up Charlie Shot the Fox Cox in that entire sentence.
No, that's probably because I think he's a great big steaming pile of poo. Steve Parrish, I can live with. Steve Parrish is fine. He's very knowledgeable, and but he spends half his time correcting that idiot. So, I'm sorry, and I'd quite happily, I wouldn't call him an idiot to his face out of the blue, because that would just be rude. I just walked up and went, oi. Idiot.
I believe you virtually just did, Martin.
Yeah, but I can't actually see him. Thank goodness.
No worries. Hey, let's talk about. Let's get off of that one before we get in too much trouble. Let's talk about what's going on in the world. You noticed a pretty amusing dust up, if you will.
Oh yeah.
Between a couple of our former world champions.
Well, poor old Rossi must be thinking, do you know what? Everywhere I look, this guy's after me. He, as everyone I'm sure is aware now, is it ValetYellow46 on Twitter, I think he is. And that is genuinely Valentino Rossi. He tweeted, I'm issuing a challenge, Gran Turismo 5, Nürburgring, drive the Zonderal, lap time is 6 minutes, 14.211 seconds. Can anyone beat that? And the response he got from Jorge Lorenzo was, that was a warm-up lap, right? Lorenzo then tweeted a picture of his time with the same car on the same track, 15 seconds quicker. Rossi replied, 5 minutes 58.2, Jorge, nice lap, I have to practice. Lorenzo has since lowered his best time to 5:48.7. Rossi's year from hell continues. I just made me laugh. I thought, the guy can't get a break.
That's hilarious. In most other circles, they'd be shit talking over, you know, probably Voice or something like that, playing that on Xbox. But the fact that they're actually doing it over Twitter is just brilliant. Gotta love it. And, you know, I don't know, maybe Ross is going to bring in a stunt driver, get Ken Block or something to come in and rip around in it for him. What else we got? We got some more Silly Season stuff.
And unfortunately, it was finally confirmed last week. What a lot of people have been worried about, the Suzuki have finally, tragically confirmed they will not be represented in MotoGP in 2012 or 2013, which for a manufacturer who, like Kawasaki, ironically the other, or not ironically, but sadly the other major Japanese manufacturer who's dropped out of MotoGP in recent years, you know, those two, they were all about the racing. The GSXR and the Kawasaki's, it was... I mean, you could say Honda is similar, but I mean, Honda have always got those 40 million Cub 50s they churn out every year, you know. I feel absolutely gutted for Paul Denning and the Crescent Suzuki team. And Suzuki have said, well, we're looking to come back in 2014. That's not going to be easy. Duncan Bishop was saying today, you know, that's a really tough trick to pull off, because there'll be no infrastructure to come back into. All their team have gone off to find other jobs. One of the, I forget his name now, but one of the senior mechanics is going to be Andrea Dovizioso's crew chief at Tech Toi. You know, who are they going to come back with? I think it's a real shame. I think it's very short-sighted. And they could have, even if they just stuck with an 800 and got their butts kicked, at least they'd have been there.
But, you know, on the other hand, Martin, if you look at what's happening right now, and not to say that the loss of Suzuki, although their focus is obviously elsewhere and probably going to do some serious ass-kicking in World Superbike now, is that building the infrastructure that you're speaking of may not, you know, we can look to the model of the CRT folks putting together some of these teams. And maybe what they're doing is they're kind of watching the whole thing to see how it's going to pan out, which I think there's some logic to that. It's not logic that I like or logic that actually will please all the Gixxer owner fans out there. But at the same time, if their results haven't been staggering, even though we saw a brilliant, you know, last half of the season from Bautista once he returned from injury, maybe it's not the worst of ideas for them to take a break, look at the state of things of to come, literally, because the first year with CRT is going to be really, first year with the whole thing is going to be really weird. And it's going to be, there's going to be so many changes, and think about how expensive all of those changes are going to be, Martin, for all the things you're doing. Build up a reservoir of knowledge and a team structure that may allow them to actually come back stronger than ever with some up and coming racer or somebody very solid that's looking for a ride in a couple of years. I know it's not that I'm blue skying. I'm just kind of trying to look on the potential positive side of things. You know, we've got a Kawi engine back in MotoGP again. We've got stuff like that going on. So my short answer is that it may not be the worst of ideas. And as you say, they do
not from their point of view, maybe. And I suppose they have got to look after themselves.
I love the part at the end that it says Martin's still ranting, and it's a valid rant. But it may give them the opportunity to gain some success that they haven't had since 2000 when Kenny Jr. won the title.
I just think they're going to get left so far behind that it'll be difficult. But it did leave, because we were hoping if they did stay, Bautista had finally signed for Gresini.
Right.
We believe on a factory, or almost factory. Don't know if he's got the same deal as Marco Simoncelli had, but certainly not on a CRT bike. Which then left RDP, Randy DiPugno, looking at Suzuki. They've now gone. Now, this next item I entered a few days ago, so it's a bit out of date. Where does RDP go next? No ride yet for the crazy sideways Frenchman. And, of course, his lovely fiancée, Lauren Vickers. There were rumours of World Superbike or Ducati test rider. However, it's now looking possible that he may ride an Aspar CRT bike based on an Aprilia RSV4, more of which right now, because he's been testing it along with Alex Hoffman, and it's rather looks, I got this from GP Week today, and Michael Scott is a very, very well-informed gentleman. Aprilia are going to offer to CRT teams a complete package. It will be a ready-to-take-out-of-the-box-and-race RSV4-based CRT bike. And I said, interesting, very interesting, because it needs to be said in a James Bond uber-villain-style German accent. I'm suggesting Alex Hoffman is a James Bond uber-villain type of chap.
Somebody was mentioning to me that he'd been testing it the other day, and and I said, well, he's just a journo with a bit of a wink. Very interesting sidebar. I still harken back to, I think it was 2005, 2007, when he got
2006, wasn't it, where he was accused of lack of moral fiber?
Well, it was...
He pulled in for a couple of races, didn't he? Just said, look, the bike's unrideable.
Well, no, so pull it back even further when he got torpedoed by Sylvain Guintoli at the top of the corkscrew and basically put a lever through the back of his hand. Long time ago, but certainly carrying the journalistic flag right now with German TV. I think he does German Eurosport, I believe. Yeah. And if I'm wrong, Alex, I'm sorry, and feel free
And he can often be seen elbowing his way past Azzi Farni to get interviews around the paddock. So
yes, he can. Well, he's certainly got the size on her, which is not saying a whole lot, or is saying a whole lot for your average MotoGP rider. But Azzi is not the tallest lady in the world, although very
cute. No, and she gets on really well with Danny Pedrosa, and that's probably because she's the only person who ever interviews him he doesn't have to look up to.
Oh, we are so cruel. Azzi is a darling. She's very fun to hang out with.
Oh, no, she's fantastic. Yeah. So's Danny. Everyone is, in fact. Absolutely everyone's lovely.
In that same German voice, I just say, I know nothing.
Yes. For me, the podcast is over.
Yes.
Brilliant news. Because, well, I say brilliant news. I like him. Ant West. He's back with the CRT for 2012. And that one was got from himself. Info. He is on a CRT bike. We're not exactly sure what configuration it's going to take. But he's a really interesting guy, Ant West. And I think people who only saw him for those couple of seasons where, if it wasn't wet, he was last...
Well, so, Mark Martin, here's a very interesting thing that I heard posed by some people that have been in the racing scene for quite some time. So something you probably didn't read somewhere else I hang out. Some of them came up with the thought that perhaps one of the reasons they brought in Ant is because it's been discussed more than a few places that the CRT bikes, while they may not necessarily, or probably won't be competitive with the factory bikes right off the bat. Some may just nail it right off, very quickly, but there are going to be some that'll struggle. But they may actually do very well at the lower horsepower tracks, the stop and go type tracks, or
when it's wet.
And if you're going to have a CRT bike that might struggle in places, why not have a rider that is renowned for his wet finishes?
Oh, you can't call him a wet specialist.
Why not?
Chris Vermeulen should be following along. And, well, that's interesting because that kind of fits with James Ellison, who was signed with Paul Bird CRT.
Indeed.
And James Ellison is British, so he's very used to riding in the rain, and he's very good at it.
I'm just saying there's some very good, there's some logic going on that a lot of people aren't grasping right now. Whether or not it's the truth, but I think we will certainly see if this comes to form. And we know that, Ant spent the first year in MC on a shit bike. I mean, I don't think we can put it any plainer than that. They didn't definitely got an updated chassis for this year, and he had some results and certainly had a great one. I think he got a 6th at Valencia battling with Kenny Noyes, who was a great result for him as well. But he's got whatever he's on. If the team itself has its act together, it may very well be cool. And it's kind of neat. And James Ellison, we know, did really well at the end of this last year for the Parkagar squad, or Bogdanka squad, I guess.
On Supersport, yeah.
Yeah. And so, heck, we may get some surprises coming up this year.
I think James Ellison and Ant West, they're good, solid riders. They're probably, without the experience, they're in the Colin Edwards mold. They're not going to come along and suddenly surprise everybody, I don't think. But they will be consistent, I would hope. Oh, and of course, and the next thing is David Emmett has, we've drawn this from David Emmett, it's Speedmaster that Ant West is going to on the CRT bike, meaning that Andreas Iannone is going to remain in Moto2 for another season, which is probably not a bad thing.
Probably not. I mean, you know, we saw a lot of brilliance out of him, but then also not mediocrity, if you will, but just kind of maybe a few mistakes as the year went on. Mm. You did have a shot going at the Moto2 grid or MotoGP grid, or the grids all around from David Emmett. Before we do that, we did have testing today, the 23rd of November, at Jerez, and I think they're going to be testing tomorrow as well. Colin Edwards, nice to see him actually back out there battling from injury, testing on the Suter Forward Racing team bike, and as well as Yanni Hernandez and a whole bunch of the Moto2 guys. So that, as you and I speak, finished up just a few hours ago. I don't have the results handy, and frankly, this
well,
is...
it's only team times. I think Scott Redding was quickest.
Yeah, but you, as you and I well know and we've discussed before, none of this means crap right now.
It's testing, yes. Good to see Colin mended enough to go out and test.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, the first real good opportunity for him to get on that bike, and now they start sorting it, right?
Yeah. And then let's face it, if you're going to have anyone to try and sort it out, then he ain't a bad person to have on board.
That's what they say. Let's pop through some of these, the names that we know of, we don't necessarily need to go into, and, you know, some of the bike names may change. Who knows how that's going to work out, but the guys we know and the guys we don't and the guys that are still waiting to happen. You're always best at this, Martin. I'm going to let you drive this, and I'm going to sit here and enjoy a beverage that is still cold.
Excellent. Now, we've got down as number one, Casey Stoner. Well, we know he's with Repsol Honda. He's staying the next year. I'm sure, I should have researched this, I'm sure I read somewhere that he's actually said he's going to stick with 27. Hmm. That might be wrong. If any listener can remember reading that somewhere, please do email in and put it straight. Number four, Andrea Dovizioso is Monster Tech Twire Yamaha. Number five, Colin Edwards at the Suter BMW with Ford Racing. Hector Barbera, number eight, with Pramac on their sole Ducati GP12. Then we've got number nine, Danilo Petrucci, who is, we believe, with on an FDR chassis with an Aprilia engine. Iota Racing CRT now. Petrucci came second in the World Super Stock this season. I wonder how he'll get on. That's several leagues he's jumped. But there you go. Number 11, Ben Spies, staying with Yamaha Factory. 13, Ant West on an FTR Aprilia, we think, with Speedmaster. Carol Abraham, fantastic season he's had, and he's coming back on the Guardian AB Ducati GP12. Number 17, Alvaro Bautista on the Honda RC213 with Grassini. Number 19, 26, Danny Pedrosa, staying with Repsol. Cal Crutchley, 35, staying with Monster Tech to our Yamaha. 46, the Doctor, Valentino Rossi, remaining with Ducati Marlboro. Stefan Bradl, currently number 65, may have a bit of an issue with that next year because Dorn have requested the FIM to retire the number 65 because of Loris Caparossi's 22 years service, which is ironic because that's exactly what I did in the British Army. I wonder if Loris will get a pension.
you remember he was signed to be the safety director.
Yes, he's going to be the permanent member of the safety commission. I'm thinking, well, he caused an awful lot of crashes in his younger days. So that is the original poacher turned gamekeeper, isn't it? So Stefan Bradl is on a Honda RC213V with LCR. Nicky Aiden, the County Marlborough, we know, number 69. 77's James Ellison on the Paul Bird CRT, and 99 Jorge Lorenzo on the Yamaha Factory Racing. Those are confirmed. Unconfirmed, but possibilities or likelihoods. Michel Pirro with possibly a Grassini CRT entry on an FTR Honda Fireblade combine. Yoni Hernandez, maybe with BQR CRT on an FTR Kawasaki. That would be interesting. Ivan Silva, someone I don't know much about, in Matek, and the team being BQR CRT.
Hey, Martin.
And then Aspar.
Ivan Silva, correct me if I'm wrong, filled in on the Primac bike a couple years back, I think.
If he did, it slipped my mind.
Okay, I think he did. Carry on.
Alex Espargaro and Randy DePugno, both possibilities for Aspar. We did think Alex Espargaro might be riding Moto2, but they filled that slot, and we'll come on to that in a moment, for Moto2. So they're only running two Moto2 bikes. We think that Aspar, because the Aprilia has been tested by Randy DePugno and Alex Hoffman, may well be entering RDP and Alex Espargaro as CRT entries. Carmelo Morales, now this has been strongly mooted that he's going to come in on a Suter BMW with Team Laglisse. So those are unconfirmed. Carmelo Espeleta has been pushing hard to say, yeah, we are looking at 23-24, which if we do, I believe that's going to be the best year since 2004 for starting numbers.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised, Martin, if we didn't see if some of the CRT teams, either through funding or maybe whatever, maybe perhaps just the fact of that they may have hit the ground completely wrong, may not switch around a little bit. You remember the same thing happened in Moto2. We had a lot of teams start and not make it. I think we might see the same thing in GP.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Just going back to the Bradl number issue, it is more than just a personal preference as well. Apparently that number 65 is part of a personal sponsorship deal. So that could be a bit of an issue. But in Moto2, Aspar, as the by far now the biggest team in the across the three series, in the circus, if you like, they've confirmed Tony Elias is coming down to Moto2, and Nico Tirole is coming up to Moto2, the 125 champion from this year. So that's going to be an interesting little battle.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think Bradl being up there is going to be fun. You know, he might get – it's interesting because if we had Marquez had continued on throughout the rest of the season, right, Marquez may have made the step up, all dependent upon how Moto2 ended up this year.
I'm still not convinced he won't.
That's an interesting
– I would not be – I can't remember a silly season that where everything ran this late. Now, I know it's largely because of the CRT issues and people aren't really sure, but, you know, when we went from 500s to the 990s, from 990s to 800s, and there was that uncertainty, who's going to suit these new bikes? Who's going to do this? Is someone going to stay with a two-stroke? And I don't remember it running this late where we have so many uncertainties. It wouldn't blow me away to hear that suddenly LCR or Grassini or possibly his own team move up with a quasi-factory Honda.
You know what? Since we're in speculation land right now, on that same note, wouldn't it be interesting if you had one of these riders that may or may not have made the step from, say, Moto, or let's take Iannone as an example, okay? Yeah. Because we're not 1,000% sure on what his plans are for 2012. Wouldn't it be interesting if a team signed a top hardcore up-and-coming rider into the CRT group that was, you know, I mean, I think that's what we're kind of waiting to see if it's going to happen. I don't see it happening this year, but I think, as you say, silly season is still going on, and I don't think all the surprises are done yet. I agree with you.
No, but I do wonder if an awful lot of there aren't a lot of them, but a rider like Marquez, who will have people whispering in his ear how good he is, how, you know, the future is his, et cetera, would accept, you know, going to something which will be perceived as risky. Unfortunately, when you have the profile that someone like Marquez has, you're going to have managers and management teams and people really worrying about, oh, you know, the next step could be the first step downhill. We've got to call everything right. You've got to be seen in the right light. You've got to be taking steps forward, etc. I don't know. I mean, I think the likelihood is he'll stay in Moto2 for another season.
I think so too. But I think these transition years are always interesting from a perspective of everything's getting tossed in a blender, and for the first year, you never know what is going to rise to the top. I mean, as you said, we saw it in the transition to 990s. We saw it to some extent in the transition to 800s. While we lament and we bitch and we have all these things about the rule changes, you usually see something interesting that comes out of or at least something that we can talk about, certainly, Mark, that comes out of these changes to the rule structure, and especially the way that they kind of shuffle the teams around. And, Guy, you've been back when you were just a fan, not a host. You remember how Jules and I were bitching about the initial idea of going into Moto2, right?
Yeah.
We warmed to it. In fact, right now, I saw a poll somewhere. I know where it was. It was on the Wira board. Hello, Wira board. What was the best racing this season for 2011? And Moto2 was second on that list. And the probably very rarely seen outside of the U.S. Daytona Sport Bike class, which kicked ass here in the States, and perhaps had a little bit of prejudice based on a lot of the riders that we were coming there. But with Moto, a lot of people looking at Moto2 as being the class to watch for 2011 from an excitement perspective, they hit that formula right. Might they do the same thing in 2012 with the factory/CRT distribution?
It could well be. I mean, and it's interesting, after the protests about Moto2 and then this is quite good. There's been much less protest about the demise of the 125s, even though that is it. That's the end of smokers, because they did that as well. But, you know, that big blue cloud of two-stroke oilers, they all shot off. We won't see that again at the world level. But there hasn't been that much whinging about it, and I think everyone's looking forward to Moto3. I mean, at Silverstone, they had the model of the NSF 250R, the Honda effort. It's a stunning looking bike.
Yeah, and they had a couple of them out testing post Valencia, even though the weather was shit. I think they'll be fun.
But the purists will note the times, and if they're not quicker than 125s, they'll whinge and say, you know, we'll have to step back. Who cares? It's someone was making the point the other day that, you know, Moto2 got slated for being slower than World Supersport. Who cares? They're not racing against each other.
No.
I mean, if they were massively slower, then fair enough, it would be an issue. But, you know, we're not looking at testing times.
Well, but I mean, ultimately, if you look at it, Martin, Moto2 got quicker and quicker over the span of 2 years, to the point where they were not considerably, but yes, faster than the World Supersport guys, who had probably an extra 10 to 15 horsepower on them. But Moto2 guys are all in these custom chassis that have had time to develop, and the same thing's going to happen with CRT. It's still, and CRT actually has the potential to be the step that we hoped that Moto2 would have been when it started, instead of the spec Honda CBR 600R engine, because they've got a little bit more flexibility going on.
And I mean, I was quite surprised to see that the control engine has been extended for another two seasons.
But I mean, look at it this way. So that provides a sense of stability for the Moto2 grid while hopping back into the Shark Pond that will be the Moto3 grid. You've got a whole bunch of crazy stuff that's happening down there, with the exception of, you know, spec ECUs and the few other things.
Yeah, but the beauty of that...
Yeah, but you've got different motors.
Moto3 is, you've got a lot of manufacturing. Now, okay, Honda have built theirs from the bottom up. It's brand new. It's a brand new engine. But you've got a lot of manufacturers who already have four-stroke, single-cylinder, 250 engines, which they use in motocross or your off-road bikes, which I'm told by people who understand these things can be quite easily modified to a road racing bike.
But that, I mean, that being said, if you look at the ones that we've seen exposed to this point, everybody that's serious about it has purpose built a new 250, which I think is brilliant, because
absolutely.
Yeah, as time goes on, that's the original core of the market. If we can take these small, and okay, granted, this is a failing of mine because everybody knows that I loved racing back in the day, my small displacement bikes, but, and I desperately wanted the Moto2 grid to actually be 400 inline fours or whatever, 400s. I thought it would. But if we can start building some high performance 250s, and the manufacturers can also take back from that and get additional fuel efficiency out of it, that'll probably be required as things move on. Then that will trickle back down to the public way, way faster.
Well, I remember hearing Professor Julian Ryder, who's not technically a professor, but he should be. He should definitely have an honorary degree from doctorate from some university of racing. But he got really excited about this Honda NSF, and he said they're building 450 of them. 450 bottom up, pure racing, small capacity engines. They'll sell them around the world. They will say to people, "There you go, let's go racing." And you can have national series running them, which of course helps Honda out, because then all these people moving up the levels to the World Series,
sure,
going to say, "Well, I'm going to stick with that because that's the bike I'm familiar with." And you cannot take away from Honda what they do for racing. They are fantastic in that sense. It's just they have a Machiavellian approach to winning.
I will lay this out there. If somebody has one of these purpose-built GP bikes with a single cylinder 250, I would be happy to come out and rip it around your nearest track and give my impression back to the Motopod fan base. That's an official.
Yeah, and if you're European based, I'm happy to do that as well. I've only crashed once on my track days.
You might fit better, Martin.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I'm a little tall. You're a little wide these days.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. You know what? Yes, we've got a whole bunch here, and you and I have done what we normally do, and we haven't done it for so long. We forgot how well that we can rant on and on. So let's move forward, sir.
Well, I think there's a load of stuff that's come out recently on the rules that the Moto3 minimum weight goes from 135 to 140, and there's no combined maximum weight of rider bike. So that is the weight of the bike, not the combine. Sure. The CRT bikes using stock engines, they're going to be able to open the gearbox for gear ratio changes due to being cassette style, not possible to do without breaking a seal, so that'll be allowed. There's a limit being put on carbon disc diameter, two different masses will be allowed to use, etc., etc. The biggest thing, and this is where we might get it, I'm not quite sure who wrote the bottom bit, but about the liking the brake lever protectors. Brake lever protectors are now going to be mandatory, and it is about time.
Right.
But the testing ban. Now, the testing limit, they have kept a limit on the test because they will only be allowed, I believe it's 240 tyres for testing in the season.
Right. And they still have the winter ban, keep in mind.
Yeah, yeah. There is no racing now until we start at Jerez. No, right.
Yeah, so basically until, what is it, early February?
Yeah.
Sometime.
We've got a two-month break. Yeah. And then you've got the first official test. However, through the season, the teams will be able to test at their nominated test track, and it doesn't matter who rides it. Now, one of us guys, I say us guys, it wasn't me, has said, and I know Gonzalo feels strongly about this, that this will help the Europeans far more than the Japanese, because they're a bit too far from European tracks to be able to use the advantage. It will help the Japanese from the point of view that they can fly Jorge Lorenzo, Ben Spies, whoever, to Japan, where the test facilities are, and rag that bike. Now, they might not get track information for a track that they're going to race at, but they will get bike and rider information.
Well, and you can also look at it this way. Even though a lot of people don't look this far out, but you've got the Australasian tour at the end of the year, when teams are really eager to be able to get some final feedback when riders are already over there, Martin. And it's not always such a matter of money getting the riders over. It's a matter of time. And we've got some decent gaps in those races where guys can, you know, so Motegi in Malaysia and Phillip Island, they're there. Use them, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And what I mean, the Catty guys this season were gagging for was just a, you know, can we just go to one of the tracks, even if it's a track we don't race at, in between races, and have Valentino and Nicky take the bikes around? Because with the best will in the world, your test riders are not going to get those bikes. I mean, I heard an interview this season with the Bridgestone, one of the Bridgestone team bosses, and he said even with the race rider on the race bike, on the race circuit, when they're testing, they don't quite get the same performance from the tyres as when they're racing. Because when they're testing, they can run at 100%. When they're riding in a race, they sometimes go a little bit over that, in terms of that 100% being, this is the fastest I can go and definitely not crash. Well, sometimes when they're racing, they do that. Well, this is as fast I can go and I might crash. Well, equally, I might win. Because if I don't do this, I'm not going to. So, you know, I think it's a good move. And particularly with it, they had to do it with the CRT. These guys can't afford a year when they restricted.
No. Yeah, no way. No way. All right, what else we got going on?
We had the Valencia test. I don't think we need to go exhaustively through the
It's nearly old.
What was interesting.
Yeah, it's nearly old news at this point, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, with Jerez test starting today for Moto2. What was interesting was you had day one and day two, and then there was a day three at Valencia, and a lot of the riders trying different chassis. Now, there does seem to be a large-scale defection away from Suter to Kalex and FTR in particular. Mark VDS have gone to Kalex. Speedmarsh have gone back to FTR after a year of spectacularly varied results with Iannone on the Suter. Now, supposedly, now that this is a quote from GP Week, most teams are saying that it's less to do with increased costs or performance and more to do with the fact that Suter blatantly favoured Marc Marquez during this season. And it was just a case of, hang on, he got something. They had the capacity to provide to everyone else. They give it to him, and no one else would see it for two or three races. And you think, okay, you can understand that hacking people off.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I pause for your comments, sir.
Well, I'm thinking about it, and it seems like that's a fair bit of a wholesale jump, but they may know something that we don't.
I wonder if Suter is putting an awful lot of his eggs in the basket of MotoGP CRT as well.
Well, I mean, that's a fragile basket to throw things into. And damn it, I've been saying this for more than a few times, but today the Motopod family will be happy to know that wasn't a cut there. I'm just pointing this out that I will have my internet installed at my new place this coming Saturday, which means that I can actually go out and start getting some of these interviews that I've mentioned that I wanted to get. And I think one of the first ones that I'm going to track down, Martin, will be a gentleman named Eskil Suter.
Yes.
And I think it's time to get him back on. He's a lovely man to talk with. And I think might be able to answer some of the questions, a lot of questions that we've had over the last year or maybe even 2 years, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, the last set of interviews you did with him were fascinating at the outset of Moto 2 with the sniff of CRT on the horizon. Well, it's on us.
Yeah.
It's here now.
So that is a definite for 2012, because I have corresponded with him once or twice, and he definitely is going to be talking with us at some point. So I might as well take what unfortunately is a rather an underemployed weekend or month for me, or at least next couple of weeks until I regain gainful employment. I will be available to do some of these things. So I'm going to use that time to get some interviews for you guys, which have been sorely lacking from my perspective or my own output for some time. So let's see if we can't kick that out.
Well, I have a personal ambition for 2012, and this segues us nicely onto the next item, which is a quick chop across the World Superbike that I'm going to bust my gut to try and pin down John Hopkins for a face-to-face interview.
Nice.
Because fantastic news this week. Gutted though we are that he's not going to be, I think, certainly my hope was he'd be joining Alvaro Bautista at a two-bike Suzuki effort for next year in MotoGP. I think he's thoroughly deserved it after the fantastic season he's had. He's returning to Crescent Suzuki for another year, but not in BSB, because the whole team are moving up to World Superbike, which I just think that's fantastic. Jack Valentine's going to run it. Whether Paul Denning will be a lot more hands-on, because he owns the team, and obviously he doesn't have a MotoGP involvement now, and I suspect he won't be able to stay away. And his teammate is going to be Leon Camier, yep, who, if we all think back to the early noughties, when Casey Stoner and Chas Davis, with Leon Camier, they were the young guns who just dominated the youth British series, or the small capacity British series, and they were unbeatable, those three. That is going to be interesting. Leon Camier and John Hopkins, World Superbike. I mean, he ripped up Silverstone when he went there as a wild card this season.
Sure.
I just think that, you know, everyone deserves a second chance, and he's taken it with both hands. It was gutted he got injured, particularly wildcarding at Brno. But even with that, he lost the BSB championship by 0.006 of a second. I mean, congrats to Tommy Hill. He's another one who's had his adversities, you know, with injuries with Tommy. But, you know, it was a brilliant season, and I just think hats off to the guy. It's fantastic to see him. And you know, with a good few years left in him with any luck.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely. One interesting thing too, I think I forwarded this to you, but Yoshimura, fantastic. First thing I want to say is aftermarket, but they're really not. They're also a massively successful team, both in the World Endurance, primarily Suzuka 8 Hours, but certainly over here in the United States, they were the team that hosted both Matt Mladen and Ben Spies, and we all know what he's done since then. And they know how to make Suzuki's go fast as shit. Have partnered up with Crescent. I think that's a great, great way to put a couple of team, you know, solid people together.
Well, but, as Jules has put in the notes, this could be awesome.
Yeah.
If it's definitely, said definitely. Your side of the
pond. That awesome is in all caps, ladies and gentlemen. So.
Awesome. Yes.
What else we got going on? Next week, Mr. Jules Cisek and myself will be in San Francisco for the Northern California premiere of Fast. Just a lot of people, a lot of you out there already have the DVD in your hand or are watching it as we speak or type or whatever you happen to be doing. We already know what it's about. I have not seen it yet. I am on a personal embargo to not see it until I see it in the theater. I think Jules is doing the same exact same thing. We're going to have some possibly special guests up there, and I'm going to keep that a little tight-lipped, and you guys will just have to show up if you come to the SF premiere of Fastest. There is a I think I've linked to it on Facebook, but you can find it. It's at the Embarcadero Landmark Theater, December 8th at 7 p.m. in San Francisco. Jules and I will both be there, and we will have Motopod stickers. And I did manage to, with the incredible, I need to make some thanks here real quick because I've kind of missed on this. We did have a couple of donations this week, and the names elude me, and I apologize, and I need to send back email to both of you thanking you very much. But I did manage to use those to actually purchase one of our own Motopod shirts that I can wear to the premiere. I'm like, you know, I should probably have one of our show shirts.
I absolutely wish I could get over there for that because I haven't got any stickers yet.
Well, shoot, Martin, then I got to get on the stick because I think I've failed both you and Gonks, and like I've got a
MotoGP OD stickers still.
Yeah, we need to fit. Well, you don't have a Motopod shirt yet either, do you?
Yeah, I've got three of them.
You have a Motopod shirt?
Yeah, I got them made up myself.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm getting one of the official ones from the Cafe Press store. It's pretty cool, actually. And thanks again to Eric and Engel for setting that up for us. our deserter, but and I say that with great regard because I've listened to a couple of editions of Lean Angles, another podcast out there dealing with motorcycle road racing. I think they're doing a great job. Geez, Martin.
We have got to mention, I mean, talking as we were of John Hopkins and having some years left in him, the old warhorse of BSB and Real Roads Racing, Michael Rutter, won his seventh Macau GP race, becoming the most winningest rider ever at Macau. Absolutely phenomenal.
And who did he eclipse?
Go on.
Ron Haslam.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, do you know what? I never knew that. It was Ron. He tied him with six, hadn't he?
Yeah, Mr. Mutton Chop himself. And, you know, since Ron is going to be racing.
Ron had won six. I knew it was a British rider, but I couldn't think who it was. I presumed it was way back when.
Yeah, you know, there's not much. If those of you guys out there, and I'm not even going to link to it, you can figure it out and find it on your own. But pop into YouTube and look at some of the older Macau videos. Your jaws will drop.
It's a frightening place, isn't it?
I did manage to watch it live this year with a new close friend of mine. And it was wonderful. And frankly, those of you, I just have to mention this. I watched it on Chinese television. Purloined from somewhere on the internet, and you guys know how all that stuff works live. Chinese commercials, not only are they, well, not understandable to me, of course, which is understandable, they're long and they're endless. I've like 12 commercials in a row. I'm like, can you please get back to the race? Which they didn't do during the car racing. I watched, 5.5 hours of the running. And it was crazy. And Martin, I mentioned to you before the show, but I just got off before I talked to you a couple of quick calls with Mark Miller just to catch up, not stuff for the show yet, just trying to, you know, hook back up again. He and I hadn't talked for ages and we were just chatting as friends and got to say hello to Vero too. Hi, Vero. Which is always fun too. And so that was good, and we'll be hoping to have him on for 300 and the This Is Sparta episode.
Terrible film, by the way, but never mind.
Jules is screaming, spoiler!
Yeah.
All right, Martin, should we wrap it up?
Yeah, I've just got one last thing on a personal note. On Friday, I enter my Valentino Rossi tribute year.
You do, which means that are you dumping Jorge or what?
No, means I'm 46.
Ah, well, and this is Friday.
I'm about to leave my Scott Redding tribute year.
You're saying this is Friday?
Friday, yes. I'm 46 on Friday. And I was wondering if I'll ever make my Jorge Lorenzo tribute year. And of course, it might lack relevance unless he's still racing. So I need him to keep racing into his early 70s. If that's all right, Jorge.
You stay away from track days and test rides. Okay, so from everybody out here in Motopod land, from California, from Portugal, from the Europe, and all about down under, Martin, happy birthday on Friday, sir.
Thank you very much, and I'm working both Friday and Saturday.
Lucky you.
But it's okay, we're going to a charity bash on Saturday night. It's a Bon Jovi and Bryan Adams tribute band.
Are you going to wear a hairpiece?
No, I'm probably going to have to wear a flying suit so I can do a nice smiley photograph for the check presentation, because it's for charity, mate.
Yes, well, I'm sure Miss Sharon Darlington will be there looking lovely as usual.
Oh, I hope so. I shall post photographs.
I bet you will. Just don't do the whole sword thing like you did when you got married.
Oh. Yeah. Okie doke.
All right, brother. Thank you out there for listening. Please drop in and say hello on Facebook, www.facebook.com/motopod, motopodcast.com. We love you all, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Don't forget to pay attention to the Dr. Martin Raines interview. Get your answers in to 300@motopodcast.com, and we'll see if we can't get you out a Moto Matters calendar. Martin, been wonderful. It's been too long.
Absolutely, brother. Absolutely. And I'm now going to head off to bed and go to work tomorrow and hope that somebody's ill somewhere and needs me, because I haven't been flying much recently.
Well, wait, you say that and you're just going to get swamped now.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Good night, all. Yeah.